And that was Positively Revolting on Your Community Radio, KBOO Portland. And that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from One With Heart Martial Arts, offering a transgender self-defense workshop tomorrow, Saturday, March 9th, from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., located at 4231 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. Pre-registration is required and is open to all transgender individuals age 13 and up. More information online at onewithheart.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema in Corvallis. Filmed over a period of 10 years at a remote communal ranch in New Mexico, Hippie Family Values is an intimate chronicle of a handful of hippie elders along with their adult children and grandkids. The director will be in attendance. Again, that's the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema, 215 Southwest 4th Street in Corvallis, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Building Bridges to Sustainability. On Friday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at PCC Cascade Campus in Portland. Building Bridges to Sustainability features keynote speakers, presentations, and breakout sessions where participants will have opportunities to gain insights to equity, economic opportunity, and social justice while shaping a culture of sustainability. Again, that's Building Bridges to Sustainability, Friday, March 8th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 Northeast Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As mentioned, this is KBOO Portland. It's about a little after 9 on a Friday morning on International Women's Day. Host Jan Hocken will be talking about the International Women's Strike and Reproductive Justice, followed at 10. Linda Olson-Osterlin talks to former FBI Special Agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley. At 10:30, KBOO talks to Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about her journey through the political scene as a woman. And at 11, The Digital Divide with Rabia Yeaman talks to Elizabeth Fournier, a green mortician and eco-educator. That's all coming up, so stay tuned.
We go marching, marching in the beauty of the day. A million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
The song we start with this morning, Bread and Roses, has been an anthem in the women's labor movement over the past century. In 1912, a strike by women textile workers in Massachusetts became known as the Fight for Bread and Roses, the struggle for a living wage and for dignity and respect. The suffrage movement during the early 20th century mobilized middle-class women, but it also drew on the radical demands of women factory workers who recognized that patriarchy extended from the shop floor to the bedroom and that their fight was against patriarchal bosses as much as resistance to fathers and husbands. The first National Women's Day in 1909, established by the Socialist Party of America, honored women workers in the garment industry who went on strike in New York to protest working conditions. Well, today we honor those women who fought for some of the freedoms we enjoy in our own times, while we continue those struggles as they take new forms. Over the next hour, we will be discussing the International Women's Strike that is happening in cities around the world, including in Portland, and the importance of reproductive justice as a basic condition of women's emancipation. First on the program this morning, I talk with Cinzia Arruza, one of the national organizers of the International Women's Strike, about its history and demands. Cinzia is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research and a co-author of Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. We also hear from an activist with Democratic Socialists of America, Portland, DSAPDX, about local feminist organizing around reproductive justice and some of the victories this past year in Oregon. Finally, Alyssa Pariah reports on the rally and march that will be held at 4 p.m. today at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Alyssa is an organizer with International Women's Strike USA and host of The Struggle, a program here on KBOO. Cinzia Arruza, welcome to KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've traveled in this issue for some time and probably walked a block or two. You've been an organizer for the past 2 years with the U.S. Women's Strike. Can we start with the concept of the strike and some of its history? It's perhaps not a work stoppage in the ordinary way we think of as about strikes, but I know you've been asked this a lot. Is it aspirational, kind of prefigurative in a certain way?
So it depends on the country. It is not a prefigurative strike in a number of countries where today women are striking in millions. So today there is a general strike called by major unions under pressure from the feminist movement in Argentina, Italy, Spain, and Chile. So these are actually real workplace strikes that have both political and economic demands and that are involving millions of women. And the idea of a women's strike or a feminist strike, we imported this to the United States from Poland and Argentina. Poland and Argentina organized two massive feminist strikes in the fall of 2016 to protest, in the case of Poland, a proposal for a complete ban on abortion. And the women's strike won in Poland and managed to block this law. And in Argentina, the strike was organized to protest against femicide, so against gender violence. And after these two strikes, the feminist movement started coordinating internationally and exchanging ideas and proposals and analysis, and then decided to call for the first internationally coordinated feminist strike on March 8, 2017. And this is when we decided to organize a women's strike also in the United States, and we created basically within 3 weeks the network International Women's Strike. And our idea was that we needed to do this first of all in solidarity with the women who were mobilizing and striking around the world, including in countries that had suffered from U.S. imperialism, for example Latin American countries. So we thought it was important that we organized in solidarity here in the center of the empire, let's say. And the 2017 women's strike was quite successful. We managed to have three school districts shut down. And the demands were basically inspired by the demands of the Argentinian feminist movement and the Italian feminist movement. So these were demands that kept together economic demands like wage equality, minimum wage. So we supported the Fight for Quintin campaign with demands about public healthcare, public education, but also demands concerning the abolition of border walls, and the opposition against migration policies, U.S. imperialism, and so on. So it was a combination of social, economic demands and political ones.
And we
organized around this.
And the platform in that sense is quite broad and encompasses what sometimes called reproductive labor or social reproduction. And that has been a particular contribution of left-wing feminism to the labor movement and to the women's movement, acknowledging the many forms of labor people women engage in, both paid and unpaid, and which is sometimes difficult to interrupt in the course of a strike, you know, when you're when you are responsible for dependent care and so on. Can you speak to the many forms of women's work, both the way in which the unpaid labor of women is part of that platform of demands?
Yes. So this is, by the way, a characteristic of the movement on an international level, the fact that it is combining reproductive and productive strikes. So the idea is that strikes should involve both production, so workplace strikes, but also reproduction that is often performed by women through unpaid work. And the reason was that we want to make this labor visible, and especially we want to make visible how this labor is necessary under capitalism and is exploited under capitalism to reproduce people's lives, but also future workers. And the movements around the world have invented various ways in which to organize reproductive strikes. For example, in Italy and Spain, the movement has organized collective childcare that is managed on March 8th by men in support of the women's strike. So basically challenging, on the one hand, challenging gender roles and the idea that it's women who should perform this labor. On the other hand, also showing that it is possible to have a form of social reproduction, so like childcare or care for the elderly and so on, which are collectively organized, which are not relegated to the privacy of the home. So this has also a prefigurative element, indeed, in the sense that indicates the possibility of organizing social reproduction in a different way, in a way that is not exploitative to women, in a way that that is democratic and collectively organized.
Mm-hmm. From the first wave through of the late 19th and early 20th century women's movement, through the second wave of the 1970s, through the what you and others have written about in the third wave, the fates of women through organizing have differed substantially in terms of how women globally and within any country or situation have benefited from the organizing and demands of the women's movement. How do you see this global strike and the campaigns as addressing the tremendous differences in inequality among women mm-hmm. in these different situations,
exactly.
while sharing some of the same conditions of oppression?
Yeah, exactly. So what is characteristic of this movement? I wrote an article in which I spoke of this third feminist wave as a new class movement or a process of class formation. And the idea is that basically today the feminist movement is not taking place within a context of general mobilization of the society, like in the 60s and 70s with the mobilization of the working class globally. But rather, this feminist movement is directly leading the way of reactivation of class struggle. So it is through the feminist movement that the left is also regrouping, so finding ways to work in unity. And it is through the feminist movement that there is a process of redemocratization of unions, so challenging also union bureaucracies. This, for example, is happening in a clear way in Argentina, Spain, and Italy. So What is characteristic of this movement is that it has dropped the idea of universal sisterhood that didn't take into account fundamental differences among women in terms of class and race. So this movement has inherited all the reflections, for example, the work done by black feminists, but also by socialist feminists around the question of how class connects with gender and race. And this movement in a number of countries is taken as a position precisely the contestation of a whole system of social relations that is particularly exploitive and oppressive for working class women and for racialized women. So challenging, let's say, the hegemony of what we may call liberal feminism, the feminism of the Sandberg or of the world or the Hillary Clinton. So challenging the idea that women's liberation is a matter of individual emancipation or of formal rights. And of course, we are in support of, formal legal rights, but what we say is that clearly they are absolutely not enough. And also that the idea of breaking the glass ceiling as a main goal for feminism.
Right, or women women being able to enter into competition with men playing
exactly
by the same rules. Well, could you also speak a bit about the difference between socialist feminism and radical feminism and the history of, much like any movement, you have different politics. So I think we need not be surprised or ashamed of the rich history of different mm-hmm. feminist visions and notions of or analyses of women's oppression. I think the difference between socialist and liberal feminism is perhaps more understood by those who follow feminist politics than mm-hmm. radical feminism, socialist feminism. Could you say anything about that distinction?
Yeah, so radical feminism, of course, is not homogeneous, but let's say
that's right. And it's changed over time, yeah.
Yeah, and changes over time. Let's say historically the main difference was in the idea that first of all that women and men form antagonistic sex classes. The idea that women should organize in a separate way, so like strategic separatism. The difference with socialist feminism is that socialist feminism actually insisted historically on the connection between gender oppression and capitalism, but also on the necessity of broad alliances in order to challenge the capitalist system as a whole, something that cannot be done through an antagonism among sex classes, let's say. Today, the big discussion that is happening also within the movement concerns particularly the issue of sex work and the issue of trans women, because some fringes, not all radical feminists, it must be said, but some fringes of radical feminism have taken an anti-sex work position, but also an anti-trans women position. And this has been a debate within the feminist movement, but I must say that around the world, the large majority of the feminist movement today is rejecting this kind of position. So yeah. This movement is developing trans feminism, what we call trans feminism. So it's a feminism where trans women are actually protagonists of the struggle together with cis women. It is a movement that is also organizing sex workers. So, for example, in the UK, there is a sex work strike supported by women. So what the movement is doing is also overcoming this kind of positions that were present within feminist theory and feminist currents toward a much more inclusive form of feminism, a class struggle feminism. And in a number of countries, the movement is also mixed. So there are also men participating and supporting the women's struggle. So this is not, in general, a separatist movement.
And I think you raise these distinctions, perhaps, between political questions that we should resolve and put behind us, such as the transgender issue, where we have enough agreement that we're not defining biological birth as fundamental to what we mean by women, and can organize around unity. But then there are other issues that there's acknowledged areas of struggle and differences. I think there's some of that with sex work. I think there's still some important debates to be had. So I think that's also part of what you lay out with this landscape, that any vital movement will have debate and differences and needs to address them, while also coming, building on points of agreement. And I'm so delighted that you've been not only writing as an academic in this area, as a philosopher at the New School in New York, but also walking the talk and joining us on the streets. And we are very delighted to have had you here at KBOO this morning.
So
keep up the good work. There's something very gratifying about these moments when we gather, as we will later today, and know that we're in solidarity with women and allies around the world. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is Jan Hawken talking with Cynthia Arruza. Thanks so much.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had an amendment to give civil rights to women? To once and for all just really lay it down from the point of view of women. I know what you're thinking, that's just redundant. Chicks got it good now, they can almost be president. But it's worker against worker, time and time again. 'Cause the rich use certain issues as a tool. When I say we need the ERA, it ain't 'cause I'm a fool. It's 'cause without it nobody can get away with anything. Go far, like just over to Canada, to feel a heightened sense of live and let live. What is it about Americans? Like so many pit bulls trained to attack and to never give. We gotta put down abortion.
That was Annie DeFranco, Amendment, Including the Right to Abortion, in her vision of the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, we now turn to feminist organizing in Oregon around reproductive rights, losses to mourn, but victories to celebrate this year. And we're hearing from Mary here in the studio this morning, a member of Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, in Portland. Mary, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me.
So
I'm like weirdly terrified of being on the radio.
Well, that is something hopefully you'll get over by the time we're done. Channel all that terror into passion and fury for where we are today. So you're a public school teacher and mm-hmm. active in the Oregon Public Employees United, as well as very involved in reproductive justice campaigns, including through the DSA Feminist Caucus. So let's start with the good news. What have been the victories this year that DSA activists and many other feminist organizations have worked on over the past year? What's there to celebrate?
Well, last November, I guess it was, we had on the ballot Measure 106, which... Jan's moving my microphone.
It's a little bit further yet. Okay. That's good.
Measure 106 would have prohibited public funds in Oregon from being spent on abortion care. In a lot of states, no public funds are used in abortion care because of the Hyde Amendment. But in Oregon, specifically state funds can be used in Medicare programs. So for example, to cover public employees' insurance too. So like my insurance. But this law would have basically pushed us back to Hyde Amendment status in the state of Oregon. But with a lot of work, a lot of canvassing, there were a lot of groups. There was the No Cuts to Care Coalition working really hard to block this measure. And it was defeated. It did not pass. So women and people with wombs in Oregon can still access abortion care through publicly funded health insurance.
Can you just say a little bit about what the Hyde Amendment is that gets passed by Congress or renewed every year? And it's a pretty awful law.
So Roe versus Wade was passed in 19... Well, passed. It was... The case happened in 1973, right after I was born. 3 years after that, in 1976, was the first Hyde Amendment. And it's not actually a law. It's this part of an appropriations bill for like labor and health and human services funding. So it has to be reappropriated, I guess. I don't know the correct verb, every single year. So it's not a standing law. It's just something that gets put in there every year.
And Democrats as well as Republicans have reauthorized it.
Yes.
Annually.
It's part, as I understand it, is part of a spending package. So it's definitely the kind of thing that can be bargained about, you know, like we're not passing the spending passage if you don't just include the Hyde Amendment as usual.
And it restricts, other than in the most extreme circumstances, federal funds to be used for abortion.
Yes, you can use federal funds for abortions only if continuing the pregnancy will endanger the woman's life, in cases of rape and in cases of incest. And I'm assuming those are like documented criminal cases of rape and incest.
So in Oregon and many other states, the state has stepped in to provide that funding.
Provide that funding. And this year, I was, of course, reading up on the Hyde Amendment before I came over here. And of course, every year there are people in the Congress who are like, let's get rid of the Hyde Amendment, but it never builds momentum. And for the past, I'm not sure how many years, but the past few years at least, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who's from California, has been sponsoring something called the Each Woman Act, which would essentially be a permanent repeal of the Hyde Amendment. So it would put into a law all the things that the Hyde Amendment prohibits. So it would ensure coverage for pregnancy-related care, including abortion, through insurance covered by the federal government. And then it would prohibit federal, state, and local legislators from like preventing your private insurance from covering that. So that would just sort of automatically block the Hyde Amendment.
You know, before you came on this morning, we talked about, I talked with Cynthia Ruse about different feminist politics, mm-hmm. and that we have, as feminists, a very rich and complex tradition,
right.
and political differences, including in how we talk about and think about abortion in the broader context of the women's liberation movement. So I think it'd be good to talk some about ways of, in the canvassing and organizing over the last year, how do activists, socialist feminist activists, try to talk about abortion and the access, the issue of access to abortion?
Well, the way it's been presented a lot in the pro-choice, like, community and pro-choice, like literature and propaganda, I guess you call it, is a matter of choice. That's why it's called pro-choice. That abortion should not be criminalized because it's a choice that I have a right to make. Another way of looking at it, and the way that I look at it, and you know, socialist feminists that I know look at it, is that abortion is a form of healthcare. It is, you know, one aspect of reproductive healthcare. And as members of a society that is, you know, technologically, financially, economically capable of providing everyone with healthcare, we have a right, like a human right, to have our healthcare provided. And that would include all reproductive health care, including abortion services. I mean, it would also include services that you would need to have a child. I mean, it's not a one-way street. So
The choice to carry a pregnancy depends on the world you would expect to carry that pregnancy into in the form of a child, and whether it could sustain you and whatever child you're bringing into the world.
Right. And so you can look at abortion as just one, actually quite small aspect of overall reproductive justice, that you have the right to... I brought my tablet because there's an organization called Sister Song that has the best definition of this. So they're an organization of women of color. They're the Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. And they define reproductive justice as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, have children, not have children, and parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. Way more articulate than what I was trying to say. So,
The same principle, that there's something broader, a vision of a good society, that's also a counter from this tendency to demonize feminists, mm-hmm. to demonize abortion providers as though they're just waiting in the wings, as Trump would say, to snatch babies.
Right, just hanging for a chance to kill a baby.
Yeah.
No, it's like an overall...
It's quite the opposite in terms of support for women.
It's one service, that one healthcare service in a giant context of trying to provide people with a livable life for themselves, for their families, for their children, for everybody. Mm-hmm. Like if we can't create conditions in which people have basic bodily autonomy, then what are we doing?
And it's been one of the symbolic signifier mm-hmm. of conservatives that has had some real staying power with them, and in fact is one of the few areas where they can, guns and fetuses, they can work up quite a head of righteous rage and wrath, while at the meantime ignoring so much of the destructiveness of their same politics. How do you think about that place in the you were saying it we have to reclaim it as part of healthcare and part of women's lives, but it has this weight behind it, the symbolic charge, and which was important for those of us who worked on this movie that's playing this weekend, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, was to reclaim this part of women's lives as mm-hmm. a normal part of healthcare, but also to address what makes it charged for so many people.
Right. What makes it so charged for many people is, there's this view of women as being basically meant to be mothers, to be parents. Like, that is the point of women.
It symbolizes the place of women in the world as maternal, in a maternal position.
So if you are in any way interfering with that, getting an abortion, using healthcare, you are undermining the natural purpose, the role of women, which is really interesting because, like we were talking the other night, in no other area of medicine do we just accept this sort of biological determinism. I mean, this is what medicine does. It fights against the natural processes of your body. I mean, to the extent that they're natural, a lot of them are caused by pollution, things like that. But why are we allowing just this one area of what our bodies do?
Fetal tissue should, or an embryo should grow and be free to thrive, whereas cancer, something you want to combat at every turn.
I'm not saying that an abortion's not a serious decision, but so are many healthcare decisions. I mean, if you're getting chemotherapy, that's a serious decision,
And there are messy aspects of this, mm-hmm. but you're saying there's something about abortion that registers a woman taking charge of interrupting
right.
that process, something that is still in some ways, if not defined as biological destiny, as seen as women are the caregivers and perhaps in an otherwise not very caring society.
Right.
So there is something that people respond to in this idea of holding on to motherhood as mm-hmm. as a defining basic feature of women.
And then also there's, you know, just the very, 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 very old idea that, you know, your child is the child of the father. And while I don't know how many people like explicitly, consciously would say that now, there's that sense that it's not really your body. It's you're now carrying something that is somebody else's. So you don't have the same right over that part of your body.
And so there's been quite a bit of scholarly work and feminist analysis around mm-hmm. the place of terminating pregnancies in patriarchal societies mm-hmm. historically, but patriarchal societies have differed quite a bit. And even in the 19th century, the Catholic Church did not mount a campaign against abortion, a moral campaign, until after quickening, you could end a pregnancy
right.
until quickening, which has been about 4 months into the pregnancy. So it has gathered more momentum among conservative in recent decades mm-hmm. as well. And someone says they've lost ground on other fronts, like around gay marriage.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is sometimes I feel it just serves as abortion for politicians serves the function of an issue they can continually bring up, almost to sidetrack us from progress we have made or could be making in other areas. I'm a school teacher, so in Oregon we have a similar situation with PERS. Every time we try to fight for education, like revenue and funding, it's like, what about PERS? As if the courts hadn't already decided the issue of PERS. And abortion sometimes with politicians seems like they're using it like that kind of game. You know, where we want to work for healthcare coverage for all. We want to get, you know, housing stability for all. We want to work on this and work on that, but we have to continually devote time and energy just to defending our right to this form of healthcare.
And in that sense, abortion is something to fight to protect because it's so easily shunted aside and sacrificed in mm-hmm. the horse trading that's inevitably part of politics.
Right. So one of the things moving forward in the fight for Medicare for all is to make sure that abortion services are included, that all reproductive health care services are included for women, for everyone, for trans people. Because if it's not in there, people are not going to be able to access it unless they have the private funds to do so.
So that's an important, just in closing, maybe say a bit about how important this is going to be in the upcoming struggle for Medicare for all and the ways in which abortion and a broad campaign for reproductive justice that affects poor women and women of color so disproportionately can be easily sacrificed.
Well, there are two bills, as everyone knows, in Congress right now for Medicare for All. There's a Sanders bill, and then Representative Jayapal just announced hers. And the House plan, Rep. Jayapal's plan, does cover abortion care. My understanding of the Sanders bill is that it doesn't, or it's not clear. Really what we need, you know, the issue is which one's going to come through. Like, can our elected officials stand firm and make sure that that coverage does not get brokered away? And I have a lot of hope for the representatives. We have a lot of strong women leaders, I think, who came in. I mean, as a socialist, there's a lot that I disagree with a lot of them, but I think in the fight for reproductive health care, they're, I hope, going to be very strong.
Yeah, and I think there are generations clearly of younger mm-hmm. people who do not see capitalism mm-hmm. as fulfilling even a personal vision of advancement, much less a collective vision of a good society. So I think it's a good time to be a socialist as well as a feminist. These are terms that, like abortion, that have got to come out of the closet
and, we have to be really loud. We have to be loud about it. The conservative right has always been really loud and scared officials into doing things like renewing the Hyde Amendment. So we have to be as loud or louder.
And to perhaps today celebrate our victories and realize our collective strength, as well as acknowledging the losses throughout our same collective history.
Yeah, it's International Women's Strike Day.
Yeah, and we'll be hearing more about that from Alyssa Pariah in just a few minutes. This is Jan Hawken. I've been talking with Mary, with an organizer with DSA Portland Feminist Caucus, and active with the as a public school teacher with Oregon Public Employees United. And thanks for being with us this morning, Mary.
All right, well, thank you.
And when there is a promise of a storm, if you want change in your life, walk into it. If you get on the other side, you will be different. And if you want change in your life and you're avoiding the trouble, you can forget it. So Harriet would say, wade on in the water, it's gonna really be troubled water.
Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
Harriet Tubman used the song Wade in the Water as a call to get into the water so that the dogs slave catchers used couldn't sniff out their trail. Women have throughout history carried heavy loads on their backs to freedom, often with their children in tow, and yet have kept going. We now turn to organizing here in Portland on International Women's Day and how listeners can join the women's strike events at Pioneer Courthouse Square later this afternoon. We have organizer Alyssa Pariah on the phone to let us know what will be happening. Alyssa, welcome to our special program this morning on International Women's Day.
Thank you for having this special program on International Women's Day.
Yeah. Well, you're very busy as an organizer, and probably have been even prior to today, of the International Women's Strike, as well as a programmer here at Portland, in KBOO, as host with your show Struggle on Friday evening.
Yeah, the Struggle, Friday nights at
7. Yeah. So... can you tell us, earlier in the show, we talked about some of the history of the International Women's Strike, what's happening in other places of the world. Can you place us here in Portland, and what's some of the history, more local history of the women's strike?
Thank you. The women's strike had its first showing in Portland just last year. It's been going on globally much longer than that, coming out of some struggles that you mentioned and others, fights against femicide in Mexico, dam projects in India, abortion access in Poland, and the call went out to women of good conscience the world over to march under our common banner, under the International Women's Strike, because we know that that is how you win. It's not enough to ask, you must strike, right? Withhold your labor. It's the quickest way to bring a capitalist to his knees.
So, and we're talking about, in many places, work stoppages at the point of production, which has always been that, as they say, the power we have in our hands to withhold our labor and to show then how those in power depend on the labor of working people. How do you think about that concept of the strike as it applies to the women's strike?
Oh, and we see incredible strike action by people in the International Women's Strike with teacher strikes in West Virginia, Arizona, most recently Oakland, even right here, right? Evergreen Education Association up in Vancouver and in Southeast Washington. And we are honored to be able to turn out every time because, of course, these strikes are led and mostly populated by women.
So you're saying that
is always on the chopping block because it's a public good and the right wants to get rid of all public goods.
And so this idea that capitalism privatizes profits and socializes the cost of production is part of what you're describing, kind of acknowledging the cost of running a society. All of the people do this work, not only in producing goods, but producing services and reproducing the society daily and on a generational basis. So it sounds like you think of the strike partly as a way of honoring and recognizing the strikes led by women, and for the teacher strikes, for example, around the country over the past year. It's a moment of bringing forward this work beyond what's happening today as an interruption that's planned for an hour today.
Yeah, so in Portland, it'll be a demonstration to show women who are at a sort of like a better, more advanced place politically, where they are able to call for, organize, and have successful strikes around workplace and other social issues. And we want to show women, especially in the colonized and formerly colonized world, that, you know, right here in the seat of empire, in the quote-unquote, you know, most progressive city in the seat of empire, the so-called USA, we are here too, and we acknowledge you, and we're going to be bringing in stories of struggles of women all over the world this year, rather than giving local organizers the floor to sort of speechify like we do. I'm guilty, but this year is going to be about reporting back on struggles that women are leading around the world.
Can you say a little more about that? You're talking about the program today from 4 to 5.
Yeah, the program today at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Can you say a little more about that and the guiding idea behind the readings?
Yeah, the guiding idea behind the reading is solidarity is our weapon, right? That's what's on all of our flyers, and it's one of our most powerful slogans. And it's true. I mean, that's all we really have. We don't have much else except one another. So we must forge bonds of solidarity with one another. So again, today in Portland, we'll be reporting back from women all over the world. I'm looking at Nigeria, Palestine, India, Sri Lanka, of course, oh my goodness, Brazil and Venezuela, you know, really like with a right-wing boot on their neck, and we're thinking about them every day. I'm from Puerto Rico, right? The colonization continues, the Promesa Act, slashing public benefits, public spaces, the minimum wage. If you ask me, you know, I think they're just trying to get us all to leave the island so that they can just turn it into a bigger, more beautiful St. Barts. You know, a playground for the rich, and again, the colonial relationship continues. So these are the places where their struggle that we want to highlight and make sure that everyone knows about. So
I think that's
most of the program.
Principle of standing together in solidarity, that it's harder for people in power to oppressive group they're confronting than an isolated individual. And this principle, I think, often has gotten lost in the Me Too movement, where women are much more vulnerable with an individual boss meeting him in his hotel room late in the day to try to negotiate a deal, which has been such a difficult part of women's and oppressed people's lives, trying to mm-hmm. negotiate with people in power some kind of special mm-hmm. deal or treatment. And I think those are important acts of violence and oppression to confront. But you're saying it's not enough to just call to task or prosecute the boss, but to look at the conditions under which people, oppressed people, are in these vulnerable situations confronting a person in power in isolation versus standing in solidarity.
Yeah, absolutely, sister. You need a contract.
Yeah.
you need a union. You need comrades. This is the way forward. And I understand better than most, I think, the ways in which the labor movement has failed women all over the world.
It's not just corporate power or men who are enormously powerful and wealthy, but labor unions have also been places where women have been oppressed, harassed, sexually.
We must do better.
Yeah.
We're lucky enough to have women leaders in the labor movement now that are able to bring in a class struggle feminism to their locals, their nationals and internationals, and bring this out. And again, to harken back to the teacher strikes of last year and this year, that these women are showing us the way, because it is not, you know, the typical factory workers of yesteryear, you know, burly, dirty guys, you know, in work boots and hard hats. They're still there, and we love them, no doubt. You know, the struggle continues. But no, these are working women, teachers, that are facing budget crises that are imposed on them by really incredible brazen attacks to public education at large.
And there's
and
also
expected to just take it, and they're not, and thank mm-hmm. God.
And that's I think part of the question of what your identity is as a worker versus a professional. And I think it's not helpful to counterpose them, because workers have throughout history taken craft pride in what they do and bring skills to their job, just as people who are associated with more middle class professional jobs. But you see this shift, I think, with teachers, and seeing how much, and having been a teacher myself, how much we have in common with other workers who are who need to band together, that there are places you can't get to alone, as you say, without negotiating together.
Sure.
So what are you hoping for today? And we have another minute or two. Can you give us more specifics on how to get down there and what you hope to happen later today?
I suggest everyone take the MAX. So-called pioneer, can't be a pioneer if you're killing people who are already there, but there we are. Pioneer Courthouse Square is the sort of intersecting point of all of the MAX lines. So if you can get to a MAX line, I would suggest that you take it and bring art, you know, a sign, a message, bring a friend, bring a lot of friends, and show women all over the world who are in active struggle around incredible campaigns that you'll learn about, that you support them. And this is our chance. Solidarity is our weapon.
And there'll be some, as I understand it, there'll be some moving readings of women engaged in struggle around the world, but then will there be a march?
Yeah, then we're going to march to Salmon Street Springs, where our good friends at Portland Jobs with Justice and DSA Labor, of which I'm a member of both, full disclosure, will be there with the beautiful light board that Jobs with Justice does that'll say Women's Strike. So we'll be marching to them to celebrate and to say see you next year.
Yeah. And
struggle continues.
And are there ways people can learn about ongoing work, including how this kind of organizing?
Yes, womenstrikeus.org and International Women's Strike on all social media. Our platform is vast, and I absolutely do suggest that everyone read that. I mean, the politics of the International Women's Strike are a very key part of our overall work. It's certainly not just about turning people out, but it's about, like, what are we fighting for? What is our vision? What is our analysis? And I would love for people to get more familiar.
With this, this is a more, the left wing of International Women's Day, and a more radical vision of social transformation than often is proposed by liberal feminism.
Yeah, I mean, socialist feminist started the day. It's only right.
This right. Yeah, that's right. We're Sandra Goh. We've got a lot of spirits to guide us from the past, but a lot of work ahead to do.
I'm ready. Let's go, Jen. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I've been talking with Alyssa Pariah, an organizer with the International Women's Strike, and we'll meet later. Later today, down at Pioneer Courthouse Square downtown. We're gonna hear a little more music in the spirit of the morning. One of my favorite songs from a way back, Tracy Chapman talking about revolution. And then I'm gonna sign off. Let's listen to Tracy Chapman for couple minutes first.
Talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds dismal. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
This is Jan Hocken, and you've been listening to a special program this morning for International Women's Day here on KABU, focused on the International Women's Strike and reproductive justice. Thanks to Cynthia Arruza, Mary, and Alyssa Pariah for joining us, and Sonia for engineering. Stay tuned at 10 this morning. In a few minutes, you'll be tuning in to Linda Olsen Osterlund, who talks to former FBI Special Agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley. 10:30, KABU talks to Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about her journey through the political scene as a woman. And at 11, The Digital Divide with Rabia Yemen, who talks to Elizabeth Fournier, a green mortician and eco-educator. So there's a lot more on KABU this morning, and more programming celebrating the International Women's Day. And be sure to join us downtown at 4 o'clock today for the Women's Strike. Thanks so much for being with us.
KABU at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen the documentary film Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. pesticide is banned in the United States for its dangerous health and environmental effects, companies are still permitted to manufacture it for export only. Circle of Poison documents the export of dangerous pesticides and the inspiring ways communities are fighting back. Again, that's Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the live performance of the West Lynn Radio Hour, KWL 1956, on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Youth Music Project in West Lynn. For the past 3 years, the West Lynn Historical Society has produced the KWL radio show. This year, the reenactment will feature a roundup of the news, West Lynn history on parade, as the Willamette Flow soap opera, and more. Again, that's a live performance of the West Lynn Radio Hour, KWL 1956, on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Youth Music Project, 2015 8th Avenue in West Lynn. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland, your community radio. Coming up at 10, Linda Olson-Osterlin speaking with Colleen Rowley. And lots more. All day and all night, right through until at least 5:30 a.m. So keep it locked right here. Meanwhile, I am, as always, privileged, honored, as well as contractually obligated to remind you that support for KBOO programming comes from Dark Side Cinema in Corvallis, open every night featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.